Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Locker Room Access Podcast. I am Mark Jerome, joined by my main man, T-Dubs, out of Cali. And today we have Grant Kersey joining us as well. We are sponsored by Rhines and Rogers, and where Charlottesville gets engaged, and Multiverse Kitchen. We are so honored today to have the father of JPJ Arena joining us. My favorite architect, Bob Moji. How are you? Thanks for joining us today.
I'm great. Glad to be here. Like the introduction.
Well, you know what? You provided so many great, three great years for me and many, many more for so many other people. You know, T-Dubs is from the area, grew up there. Grant, of course, grew up there. And I know that every time I walk in that building, I hadn't been there, I guess, in a year or two after winning the national championship. And when I got back in that building, I just had an incredible feeling just overwhelm me of warmth and kindness and excitement. And it felt like a beautiful home that I was walking into, a gorgeous, big, beautiful home, right? That place, whether you're a fan or not, is absolutely gorgeous. You're a fan of UVA basketball, let me explain that. It is absolutely gorgeous.
Well, thank you. I think that's people do not often appreciate how important the built environment is in setting the tone and expectations for things, particularly at UVA. You know, the lawn is still considered perhaps the best thing that's ever been built in North America. So it establishes the architecture, the design of places establishes a setting that allows great things to happen. And that was sort of the goal of JPJ, is to create that kind of environment.
Yep. When you look at starting from the outside, what was the inspiration? And I said, I wasn't going to use that word because it sounds so cliche, right? But what was your thinking when your mindset, when building the outside, when designing the outside of JPJ?
That's a long and deep question. So style is a critical factor. And unfortunately, in my opinion, I'll probably get drummed out of the architecture corps for this. Style currently is defined by the New York Times Design Piece Sunday magazine piece, which the only thing politically correct is mid-century postmodern, which is really last century. You know, it's architecture that developed in the 20s and 30s in Europe, and the international style, and that's the only thing that's considered politically correct on a style way. But through working through originally Klockner, then Scott Stadium, then on to JPJ, the John Oliver, who was the assistant athletic director at the time, said, you know, how do we define Virginia's brand? Everything needed to have the same brand to it. And, you know, we had an iconic brand in what Jefferson created with the lawn. So trying to create something that was uniquely the University of Virginia, still a modern, up-to-date, fully wonderful arena, and trying to blend the two of those together so that it's made a statement about where this was and why it was uniquely the University of Virginia, but hopefully also the best one of its kind in the Virginia style.
When you're thinking of style, when you're thinking of the building, do you think outside first or inside first, and then the next part second? Like the inside is, I mean, I love the outside, right? But the inside is, you walk in that place, it's just stunning.
I think design-wise, inside is always the most important. That was the key thing that we're trying to create, is that venue that the players would respond to in a way that they would be inspired to. It's sort of like Wimbledon or Wembley or Carnegie Hall. You know, you wanted something that people wanted to come to play in, Madison Square Garden, Boston Celtic Arena. And then it's a combination of creating the place and then having the events happen that infuse it with history, that really make them sort of a magical place to play sports.
Well, clearly it's magical and been very successful for UVA. So they got the message. The players got the message because they've had an incredible record at home at JPJ, and you've had some great coaches, opposing coaches, including Rick Pitino, who have made very positive comments about, well, for him, negative comments, right? How hard it is as an opposing player, opposing team to play at JPJ. And so what was your thinking in terms of building a place that would be so successful for the team? And was it having the players, so the fans so close to the benches and to the actual court? Was that part of the thinking?
Oh, absolutely. So in some ways, the arena is conceived more as a concert hall, or as a, you know, the actual model was, in my mind, is a little bit like the Globe Theater. We wanted the fans on top of the play as much as possible. And ironically, that was probably inspired by Wisconsin's old field house. When we were working on it, I traveled a lot with the teams to look at different things. So the football team was playing in the Coach's Classic first game of the season up at Wisconsin, and they had just built a new arena up there. So we went up to see that. Terry was the athletic director at that point. So he went up and looked at the arena before the game and talked with Bo and Ryan. And we were doing that in a lot of different places. But just before the football game started, the Virginia Athletic Foundation had a reception for fans up there on the floor of the old field house, which is right next to the football stadium. And that ended in football game started. That was Matt Schaub's first game for context. But there was a giant thunderstorm came up, and they mandated an evacuation of the stadium. So all the Virginia fans went back inside the field house on the floor, and the Wisconsin fans all went to the stands above. So we were on the floor, and the stands were completely surrounding us. And, you know, they were being like fans are. They're kind of yelling at the people on the floor. And it had a little bit of sort of the Roman gladiator feel to it. And realizing the intensity, the feeling, and that's probably where it hit me the most. So most people think about the seats right next to the floor on the first level. But the most intimidating thing is actually the second level. When they're above you, you can't get to them, but they're right literally on top of you. So one of the main design goals was to get the second level as close to the fans as possible. And I think that's sort of the hidden secret of JPJ, if you will. Other people have looked at it, but they still haven't figured it out yet. But the upper deck is closer to the floor than pretty much any arena that's been built in the last 40 years.
How much of it was inspired by U-Haul? Because U-Haul had the opposite, where like courtside baseline was 100 feet from the actual court, and then the next level was so far back. How much played into JPJ and just taking the weaknesses of our existing arena?
Clearly, the U-Haul was done like there's actually three or four almost identical U-Hauls out there. But sort of just the fundamental geometry, trying to put a rectangle inside a circle, it doesn't go so well. So that was another key component. We looked at a lot of different places to look at things. And ironically, the journey of trying to get it built was challenging because the cost was beyond what anybody imagined that it should have been in the beginning. And I spent a lot of my time trying to explain to them, if you're going to do this, you got to do it right. And it's going to cost more than you think. And so at one point there wasn't enough money, but there's an idea of attaching a hotel to it. Atlantis had just come about, and the CNN center and the hotel were all integrated to the arena. And we'd come off the football stadium, which was a financial success because they could sell all the suites. But basketball arenas, because they're an indoor building, they're a lot different than outdoor stadiums. They're very expensive. You have to heat them and cool them. They're costing you money 24 hours a day, whether you use it or not. So most arenas lose money. But people build them. And the analogy I always use, when you build an arena, it's like you're building the ocean. It's expensive. You don't get anything out of it, but the shore right next to it. New Jersey people understand that the beach, the part that's waterfront, that's very valuable. So it's the things that are surrounding it where you can make the revenue. So things like hotels, restaurants, anything that the fans are spending money in besides just a ticket time is where the revenue is returned. So the arena was creating a lot of wealth, but the university wasn't going to get any. It was going to all go out to the hotels and the restaurants and things that will attract the business around it. We tried to explain that. So anyway, we took a trip, Corin Capshaw and the Dave Matthews Band jet. We went around and looked at Atlanta. I think we went to four arenas in one day. But the interesting one was Xavier. It was the first time I'd seen a three-sided arena. They had built a sort of a U-shaped, and it was just had a flat wall against the backside of it. And had like a little window, maybe a coach's office in there, but it was just a blank wall. And I said, this is brilliant, but they missed it. On an inside arena room, you actually have a space that you could create a special venue like the Green Monster in Fenway Park, something that's inside it that would give it a place. Camden Yards had just been done and everybody's raving about it. It had the warehouse in front. But before that, all the baseball parks that have built, like Philadelphia, Cincinnati, St. Louis, Shea Stadium, they were all a generic symmetrical kind of roundish building, but they had no real personality to them. So Camden Yards was the first sports venue that went back to old time, that set a specific condition that it was, you know, the Green Monster is nowhere but Fenway Park. You know, you're there to some extent. Yankee Stadium had it with the monuments and the overhang stuff that they had there, but nobody had done it inside. So when I saw Xavier and I saw that blank wall, I said, you could actually have that kind of thing there. So the idea of making a U-shaped arena sort of came about from that visit there and what we could do with that open end, which is where we have the pullout bleacher. Because as a design problem, there's two major things. It was obviously basketball was first. They made a very sound decision and not trying to make it big enough for hockey, which really compromises the geometry. But the second thing, it also had to be an event center. And that's another challenge. If you take Madison Square Garden, I don't know what it seats, 20 some odd thousand, 22, 23, but if they put a concert in there, they put a stage in there, you lose about 30% of the seats because they're all behind the stage. With a U-shaped arena, you could put the stage at one end and not lose any of the major seating to it. And with the retractable bleachers, you just, you know, push a button, the seats go back. Turnover is important, so you can have multiple events. But that's one of the secrets to the success of the arena is also not just basketball, but the event side of it. So we push the bleacher back, they can immediately set up the stage on that end. You don't lose any seating in the whole U-shaped portion of it. You can seat the floor. You can actually get more people in for a concert than you can for a basketball game, which is also unique about it. Those were the aspects of it. So then what do you put behind it? So we had a chance then to put some of the recall of the iconic architecture that Jefferson had used on the lawn on the back end of it. So when you walk in from the front door, that's what you see at the far end. When you have a symmetrical arena, it's completely disconcerting on the inside. You walk in, you walk around the concourse, and you have no idea where you are, because there's no focal point except maybe the logo on the floor or the colors of the floor to tell you, first of all, whose arena you're in and where it is in relation to the outside. But having a U-shaped arena with something iconic at one end of it, you always have an orientation point, which is very important. It's just a psychological thing of human beings. If their position versus where they are in the universe is not quite set, it's slightly disconcerting inside you. But with a focal point at one end of a basketball arena, making it not completely symmetrical, it allows everybody to be oriented to their place in the space. That may be too technical.
No, that's great. One of the things that I love about college sports, and I think most people do, is the fan experience. And if you're at home watching the game, and the fans get so excited, and I get so excited while watching the game sometimes, just because of the fans. And college fans are, I think, on the whole, a little bit more crazy than professional team sports. It's a little bit of a different environment, right? And in the old arenas, which seemed smaller, seemed like, and there's still a few schools that have maintained those old arenas, like Cameron and Virginia Tech Arena. And a lot of those fans are still on the court. And at some point, and I, you know, the Carmichael Arena, right, versus the Dean Dome, at some point, it seemed like there was a change, I guess, a concentrated change and focus on building big, beautiful arenas, right? And the Yum Center, for example, and at the Louisville Arena, which is absolutely gorgeous, right? It's probably my second favorite arena, but that's like a professional arena with escalators and one of the, and it's not only beautiful, but we've also done very well there. So
that helps.
I love it. but was there a change at some point in heart or in mind, and people said, "Hey, this could be a revenue generator"?
Well, you touched on a couple of very important points there, which is more sort of the history of design of those things. But I guess Carolina's arena is a classic example. They had a good place to play basketball. To some extent, Reynolds was good at NC State, and they replaced them with the current style of arena, which was big. It was generic. A couple things have happened, and people, it also touches on the issue of Cameron. The building codes have changed as they realized those buildings were actually dangerous. If ever had a fire or any kind of real emergency in Cameron, it's a death trap. You cannot get out of it. There's no aisles. There's no way to get out of. Everybody's crammed in there. How any fire marshal actually allows them to use that building is always a question to me. But when they went, North Carolina is a classic example. They made it big and grand and spacious, but it had no soul. And it was, and they lost that aspect of it. So one of the goals of JPJ is to put that back in. We still had to meet the fire requirements. We're going to have a certain level of generosity of space to it, but how do you still impact it to get that? So we literally designed it down to the eighth of an inch. We did layouts of, you know, here's the minimum we have to have for the exit requirements, but how many seats can we get in there? And we did mock-ups with the folding chairs and everything. How tight could we get it to the court and still meet all the fire escape requirements? And literally, you know, we found an idea that we could save another quarter of an inch somewhere so we could get another row of seats in. All of that was critically important to try and get it as tight as possible, because it's that intensity of collective human emotion that gives you that feeling that you're talking about. So that the tighter that you can make it in that, that's the key to that.
I agree with you completely. And I'm aware of the whole Cameron violation of fire codes, because I know a couple of kids who are managers and they told me that the fan base at Cameron violates the safety code, fire code, every game. And like, they don't always, I guess, count the every turnstile that when the fans go through every time it clicks and turns. I think that they, I don't know how many they count, but that place is, it's, I mean, it's great, right? For the home team, it's phenomenal. What an advantage that the home team has there. And it's an, if people haven't gone, it's a bucket list place, right? It's just amazing for the home team, and it's very hard to play there. And Grant, you know, you were there a couple of times and playing there. What, Grant, I got a question for you. What's the difference between playing at Cameron on the road and maybe a team playing on the road in Charlottesville at JPJ?
I think with Cameron, you can just kind of feel how tight it is and how kind of close space it is, versus JPJ is, it feels more open, but you still have that feeling like that the crowd is right there with you. And it's kind of not, it's not overcrowding, but they're just kind of right there backing you up at the perfect time.
And the JPJ, I'm sure employees don't violate the safety code and follow the rules too.
Definitely. And it's interesting you mentioned kind of what went into it and what you said earlier with the second level being as close to the court. Cause my first year we would have some games where we would have to film the game up there next to like the cameras and the ESPN cameras. And we used to say it was one of the best seats in the house, cause it felt like we were right there. We could see everything the entire game, and it was a cool way to watch the game versus being down closer to the court.
That still amazes me. People don't sort of get it, but the front rows of seats in the upper deck are some of the best seats in all of basketball, because they are so close to the court, but they're also up high. We have a pretty high. There's different kinds of arenas. So U-Haul is a sort of two-level arena. you have the floor level, and then you have the entrance level, and then you go up and down, and that's it. JPJ is a full three-level arena. You have the upper level, you have the mid-level, and then you have the lower level. So it's a full three stories, and that was a major design question. But with that mid-level, which where the suites are, so it also just below that upper deck are where the suites. So those suites are in good locations. Most suites are too far back. They're not good seats. So you're paying a lot of money for a suite, but they're not a good place to watch a basketball game, because and the secret to that is the lower bowl is small. And that's driven by a number of things. The funding of it was largely due to donors and people paying enough money to have access to the lower bowl. So we needed to limit that. Otherwise, it wouldn't, it's the law of supply and demand. There were a lot of debate of how many seats the arena would have in it. And people and arenas were just starting to think about becoming smaller after a history of just making it bigger and bigger. Wally Walker, I guess, was one of the people. He was in Seattle at the time, and Seattle was having a hard time selling their NBA seats, and said, you know, it really would be better if we had a smaller arena. Then people would have to, you know, if you wanted to get in, you had to pay the money. If there were extra tickets all the time, didn't matter, everybody could get in. So you want to limit the supply to be a little bit less than the demand for it. That creates excitement to get in, the desire to get in, and drives the economics of it. So by having a small lower bowl and having the VAF contribution be one of the things that allowed you to get there, that drove money for the arena and also money for the scholarship total. So there's an economic component to designing it that way as well. But the key is getting those front rows of those things as tight to the court as possible, high and as close as possible. So there's the number of rows on the lower bowl are smaller than almost everything any other arena you'll see. But that allows the upper bowl to be much closer. So you're actually getting more fans closer to the court that way.
What about planning? Go ahead, Grant.
This is a question I thought of. What do you think of the Final Four games when they take place in professional football stadiums? And it's kind of the opposite. Like the first row is way off the court, and the court's elevated, and the top row is way back there. Because I remember in Minneapolis walking to the arena for the first time and barely being able to see up to the highest level of seats.
I guess it's too late now. They debated that for a while on having the Final Four, so many people want to go, putting it in football arenas instead of basketball arenas. But fundamentally, geometry-wise, it's tough because there's places you can't see the court, so there's dead areas. I've been to maybe four or five Final Fours in football arenas, and depending upon them, I think Minneapolis is actually pretty good because it's a new arena, and they built a whole separate bleacher for it behind the Virginia side. So that was better than most in terms of, at least on the lower level, of being able to see them. But I remember being in Atlanta, you're so far away, you'd be better off, you know, going watching on TV for being there. But it's just a tough geometry for it. But there's, I guess you get that many people in there, that helps offset the fact that they're not close because there's just so many people. And I think there is a contagion to the emotion and excitement people are feeling. The more people that are packed in there feeling that emotion, that just gets contagious.
How about planning for the future with JPJ in terms of, keeping up with the Joneses, or at least the potential upgrades that are coming? Was that part of the original? Like, hey, how are we going to keep this thing updated over the years, 10, 20, so JPJ lasts? Was there anything special done for that?
There's a fundamental problem in arenas in that the span is the critical moment. Once you make that span across there, you're pretty much stuck with that. You can't really ever change that. So trying to, and every foot of span is a tremendous amount of dollars as you get further and further out there. So trying to minimize the span, but make it big enough. As I said, there's a lot of debate about the size of the ultimate size of the arena. So we did a couple things which are a little controversial. One, the span is actually shorter than the width of the arena. There's a column, there's about six rows of seats. If you go all the way up to the top that are behind the column, so you get a little bit of all-time baseball field there. You know, you have to kind of peek around it to see it from the very back seats. But that shortened the span and also gives us sort of a level of intimacy to it again. But the maintaining of it is one key thing, and then occasionally looking at things to upgrade it. So they've done a couple of things with the shifted some space around to give more weight room space and shifted the visitor locker rooms around. They've done a couple renovations to that. So that is a continual thing, but the most important thing is to have good bones to it. If the basic part of the building is good enough, that develops its own sort of sense of being a place, and that will help it last longer as well. But having a regular opportunity to enhance it both inside and outside, I think is important to keeping its longevity going.
JPJ is a remarkable recruiting tool. And I know that when we first got there and we were walking through the arena downstairs in the back, and I was mesmerized, right? And then we get to a seat and we're looking at the Jumbotron, or and they're showing us winning the league the year before. I think that was 2014, first when we won the league. I'm amazed. I couldn't open my mouth. And I was just going, nodding my head. Yes, you're going here. Yes, I want to go here. Where do I sign the dotted line? It was incredible. And then we continue the tour and we see the practice, the men's practice court, and we see the women's practice court, and I'm seeing where they give out the gear. And how many courts around the country, and I don't know if you know this or not, how many arenas, I should say, have areas where people can eat, a dining hall, have practice facilities, have an incredible weight room, have beautiful locker rooms. How many facilities around the country are as beautiful and gorgeous and well put together and well maintained as JPJ?
Very few. To my knowledge, the closest one to that is probably the Knight Center out in Oregon, which had unlimited amount of money and dedicated to Matthew Knight, the son of Phil Knight. But very few. That was one of the other key things in thinking about what it should be is the average fan enjoys basketball, complains when a player makes a bad pass or misses a shot, but they have no idea what it means to be a player and how much time, effort, and work they're putting in, and particularly at UVA where you're also going to class. So one of the goals was to put everything possible there to help them do what they most love to do. And if you go most anywhere else, you know, the practice court's in a different place, academic advising somewhere else, food is somewhere else, all of it, you have to, you know, medical attention. So the idea was to build the perfect environment with everything you could possibly need to help spend every waking second you have of maximizing your skill. I don't think anybody except somebody involved with it and seen it realizes how much effort the kids put in. You know, they want to shoot 1,000 shots. Those foul shots that they miss are a rare one because they've taken so many times, but that comes at an enormous cost of time and just the logistics of getting around. So the one of the key components of planning JPJ is to try and put everything in there. One of the fortunate things is along the way was the dining hall was added mid-construction because it geometrically it made sense, but the budget was always so tight. There was actually a magic moment in the history of the arena, and we were fighting the budget. It needed to do certain things to do it well. And Paul Tudor Jones had given, I think the number was like $25 million, and Barry Parkle had been working on, you know, for that money, you can name it, you know. And he said, nah, I don't have any desire to name it. And then somewhere along the line, I think Barry suggested, well, you don't have to name it after yourself. You know, you can name it after somebody else. And that would be really cool. My dad would like that. It changed at that moment. Once he named it for his dad, then he became more committed and enhanced his gift And through that, we got the dining hall in it, because the building is basically a horseshoe. It's round at one end, but they didn't see any need for the lower level space on the round end. So we were going to build sort of a retaining wall, and then there's going to be dirt to where the main entrance is below that. But we're digging it all out for the foundations anyway. Why not put the space in there? And finally, Leonard Sandridge, the vice president at the time, said, you know, this is a really good economic buy. You're building stuff all over the place. We're basically building everything but the space. You might as well take advantage of it. And then when they realized that they should have food in there as well, that gave us the place to put the food in. Logistical problem was the opposite end from where all the services are. So you have to take that through the building on a lower level, food in, trash out, whatever, but it allowed it all to go in there. On a similar note, on that line, is relatively late in the game, Paul Tudor Jones took his kid to a wrestling entertainment thing at Madison Square Garden, and they had fireworks and all kinds of stuff in. And he said, "Hey, I just went to this thing called John Oliver's. This is really cool. Do we have that? You know, or can we have that?" And we can probably have it. I don't know what it'll be, but we then took a trip to four different arenas and looked at their entire audio visual things and all the different things they did with lights and lasers and things, and came back and said, "Yeah, we can do it. It cost about X." And he said, "Yeah, we should do that." And the next day we were doing that. So all of those enhancements really helped put the finishing touches on something. It's a hard thing, and people complain about architects saying you should do this or should do that. It's not your money. You're just trying to build something wonderful for yourself. Hopefully that's not true in 99% of the cases, but buildings you're building for a long time and they're going to be there. And so it's really an investment in the future, and cost of things are always going to go up, and there's no better value than doing it right the first time. You build it really well the first time, that's the best money you can spend. And the problems come often from trying to cut corners on things. And so we were doing that a lot in the beginning of the arena. And by the end, people are realizing what it was, and the switch flipped, and we started, let's make sure we get it right.
Well, it's true. When you mentioned earlier, people, there's something that inspires the players when you have a beautiful arena. But I also think you can attract really good players too when you have a beautiful arena, right? And certainly, as I said, it worked for me. and I was ready to say, how could I get a scholarship here, right? But what was the thinking in terms of, was it someone who said, hey, I want to build an arena and I want to have 14,500 people there? Was that you, or was that UVA?
It was a combination of things. So ever since Ralph arrived, certainly Terry Holland, the basketball program, realized that U-Haul was limited, and we needed something better if we were going to maintain that level. So from Ralph's beginning here, there was an attempt to build a better facility and better arena, because we knew that U-Haul was dated in so many different ways. And so for various reasons, it didn't happen. So finally, I'm not sure the tipping point, I think, was the success of Scott Stadium. When Scott Stadium happened, a lot of people were against that, but that was both a big boost to the football program and also an economic win. The sale, the increase in sales of tickets and suite sales generated a lot of money. So the money that they spent on it was more than returned by the revenue that came in. And I think that was the tipping point and switched their eyes. Like, hold it, we've been not doing this because we're concerned about how much it costs. And they realized we made money when we did that. The arena was a little different thing, but that was the switch that did it. There was a lot of debate as to how big it should be and what it should be. I guess the newest arena coming online at that point was Maryland's arena was about 2 years ahead of us. So we were studying it carefully as we were doing the arena and saying, you know, if we're going to build it, you know, there's a UVA's traditions help in some ways a lot. You know, there's a quality that the lawn establishes that people want to have something of similar quality that makes a statement when you do something at UVA. So I think those two competing things, the synergy between those two help shape what the arena should and could be. The debate about seats was a completely different thing. John Castine, who was the president at the time, had come from, prior to that, being the president of the University of Connecticut, a smaller town, not much going on, but had a good, ended up with a good tradition in both men's and women's basketball. And they built, I think I want to say 12, 14,000 seat arena. I can't remember the exact number, but then was criticized because it sold out for both, because the men and women were both winning championships, and people criticizing, why didn't you make it bigger? And as I said, once you establish the span, it's hard to make it any bigger than that after that fact. So he was arguing for a larger number. Both Terry Holland and Wally Walker were arguing for a smaller number. And so the ultimate number was kind of a compromise between those two positions.
It's basically doubled the number of U-Haul, right? Yes. And I know, and T-Dubs always talks about U-Haul, and we have other people come on the arena, come on the show and talk about U-Haul too. And Grant, I think it was, you guys broke ground in 2003. And it took about 3 years. Was that the original plan, that it would take only 3 years?
It was interesting. When they finally decided to do it, they wanted the design as fast as possible. And then they wanted the construction actually to take a little bit more time because they were trying to raise money. And they also were concerned if they finished it and they hadn't raised the money, people wouldn't give the money. They actually slowed, we did the design as fast as we could, and they actually slowed the construction down a little bit. But then once they got into it, they realized, you know, that doesn't make sense. Let's just get it done. But it was basically a 6-year effort from deciding to go ahead with the original study to figure it out to when the doors open.
Wow. And clearly we're not the only ones who think on this podcast, who think it's a beautiful arena. Sports Illustrated voted it the best new arena in the 2000s. Was that an award that, is that an official award they give out? Or is that just something that they make up and put in their magazine?
It's won a number of awards. Interesting, it was also voted as the best new concert venue in the world the year it opened. And that's another sort of interesting aspect from the design side of view. It had to do that as well. And so the design of it is also focused on that. I mentioned earlier how the stage works and bringing acts in, but because of the smaller lower bowl and the geometry of it, it's a very high arena, which is part of what gives you that effect when you walk in. But that's also very good acoustically. I've been told that he said this, but Bruce Springsteen said it's the best venue he's ever played in musically because of the music. And whenever he is on a tour, he insists that he has a stop in Charlottesville, which is sort of amazing for a town and a demographic of the size that we have to get some of the things we had. One of the things we also did as part of it is do economic studies of the size and what would work and not work. And they weren't very encouraging, to be honest. You know, we have a small market share. So, you know, to get people to a show, you know, we're going to have to draw people from DC suburbs. So you're competing with the Wizards Arena and other places. They can go places. Why come to Charlottesville? But so a lot of that was done on faith, and having it turn out well was critical, because that has drawn people to it, both from not only an athletic point of view, but as a show arena. So that was critical to it.
And you got to be really proud, because you're also a UVA grad, right? And one of your daughters ran track at UVA. So to actually build something at your alma mater has got to be an incredible feeling. Something so beautiful that's been, I guess, been well received by, as you said, the whole world and the country and Sports Illustrated, and been recognized so well.
No question. There's it's also a little bit like to me, when we the moment that we were awarded that contract, and there's three golden rules in architecture. Number one is to get the job. Number two is to get the job. And the third is to get the job. Because if you don't have the job, you don't have a job. You're not doing anything about it. So when they finally awarded us the contract for that, that was one of the scarier moments of my life. I mean, I thought about it for so long, wanted it so badly. And I said, oh, crap, now we got to do it. Are we up to the challenge? So it's a little bit like making the Final Four. I'm here, but am I good enough? Can we do this? And so that was both a scary moment, but it's been fun because I've, as you said, I've been a UVA fan for the beginning. I was a 76 graduate, so I was at the ACC the first year we won the that tournament. Been to the NIT championships, been to all the ACC championships that we won, and to finally be able to do that arena, knowing what I know about architecture, that building the right place could be a key component in the future success of the arena. And probably the thing I like the best is Tony said it a couple times when he was invited here to be considered for the job. When he called Lauren back, he said, Laurel back, he said, they got everything here it takes. I mean, the arena is incredible. The fact that he recognized it had all those aspects just sort of was confirmation that we did our job.
Maybe, well, I'd love to hear your championship story. You were there in Minneapolis. What was that experience like for you?
It was funny. It was an accident. I mean, I'd followed the team. I've been to every major victory championship we've ever had by whatever reason, but had been excited about our other teams that I thought would be there, had made arrangements to go to the Final Four, had made no arrangements to go to the Final Four. I had a speaking engagement in St. Paul that weekend, and it was only a couple of weeks out, and I realized, oh, the Final Four is there. We could get there. I better find some tickets. So I called Dirk up and got some tickets to the Final Four, and I was there for this conference in St. Paul. And so for the semifinal, had four tickets, and one of the guys that works with me was there with me, and a couple other people from the conference just said, hey, you want to, a woman that I had known quite well, it was the National Green Schools Conference, and her son, she brought to the conference. He was a basketball player from Vancouver. Said, hey, you want to go to this thing? And so the four of us went to the semifinal, hopeful, but not necessarily after the miracles of getting there. So we went to the semifinal, won that, and then took the train back to St. Paul and immediately started calling my, daughter, who'd been to so many games with me over the years, and she flew in for it. And so the excitement that this could really happen, I was trying not to get overly excited about it, which is hard. But we came in from St. Paul, and having become good friends with Terry Holland and others in athletics, become superstitious. So I want to do the exact same things that I had done before. So it went to this exact same, we had ate at a little sushi place in the second story of a mall overlooking where they had a sort of press set up for things going on. And we had eaten there for the semifinal. So we took everybody there for the final. And as we were standing in line, it was about time to go and was running out of time. Justin Anderson, apparently you, a couple other people showed up. A guy that my daughter had gone to school with were there and said, hey, it's really crowded. It looked like we're like, hey, just cut in line with us. We all had a very quick meal of sushi, egg rolls or whatever. Yeah. And then for whatever reason, President Ryan and a bunch of the people he were with were just standing outside of that, looking over at the press conference going on. We came out of there, they were there, and there was maybe 18 of us all together, walked through the tunnels over to the arena together, all with a tremendous amount of excitement about what could happen.
That was really cool. We had President Jim Ryan, Joe Harris ended up showing up right there, and then Sanchez showed up. Coach Sanchez showed up. It was pretty cool. And the guys in the astronaut outfit, do you remember them walking? They were right there as well. That was kind of crazy. But
no, it was that the whole thing was just magical.
Yeah, it was surreal. Now it's kind of interesting now, like, you know, just watching the Final Four, it gives me all of those memories right back. And it's like, we're not even part of it, but yet we were just talking, you see the highlights, you think about it, and it's just like takes you right there to that moment, which is kind of unreal. I didn't anticipate that. Let's say that.
Well, there's actually an interesting thing that relates to JPJ. The number two most important factor in memory is place. If you can recall a place, you know, if I say, you know, bring up something about your high school, your homeroom, instantly your mind goes back to the space that was. And then that starts triggering memories of teachers, classmates, and different things. So just recalling a space, a place, is the number two most important thing in the recall of memory. So when you're building a place, you want to build something unique enough so that it helps the mind have the imprints in it that will solidify memory around that. So that's a hidden thing that people don't understand or realize, but that is a critical component in why those memories are so good if the place is special.
Absolutely. Speaking of places, what are your favorite arenas outside of JPJ and why?
Favorite arenas outside? I'm biased. I don't like any of the others. I liked Old Reynolds, which is almost identical to Cole. So NC State's and Maryland's, and maybe that's an era I grew up in. The iconic basketball games were when NC State had David Thompson and Len Elmore and John Lucas, and the battles that they had together. So the games were great. The arenas were almost identical. Went to both those places. Growing up in New York City, obviously Madison Square Garden. I mean, I grew up, started my freshman year in high school in 69. So that was Walt Frazier, DeBuscher, Reed, you know, those guys. That's to me when basketball became real and defined, you know, the thing that's most important to me about Virginia basketball is that we have done it right for quite a while. I think Terry Holland's defense and focus on everybody playing together as a team, and certainly Bennett does that very well now. But that, to me, the roots of how the Knicks won with five sort of players all doing their role, six or seven players when you add in the bench. But, you know, Bill Bradley searched for the open man, as opposed to the stardom that has become the thing today. And I love Kobe Bryant as a basketball player, but to some extent I credit him for ruining the game because he was so good. There was no such thing as a bad shot. He'd get over half court and he could rise up anywhere. Hey, that's a good shot, Kobe. but it lost the essence of five players giving everything they have to make each other as good as they can be and find that little moment where you can, you know, find the guy for the open pass and the shot.
I'm going to contest that and say it was before Kobe.
It could be.
Yeah. But when you walk into an arena, what's the first thing you think about? I got to imagine it's different. It's like someone who watches a movie maker or a filmmaker who watches a movie. They don't watch it for entertainment value like I do or like most people do.
No, it's the concept of the arena. What is the idea of it? What kind of arena is it? What were they trying to do from a sort of pure geometry point of view of laying out this building? What was the aspect of it? And unfortunately, too many of them are copied off of sort of a generic template, as opposed to being thought out for what this particular site, this location, this particular institution that you're building for, what can be special about it.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, the beauty of JPJ is just, I can't say enough about it. Yeah, it's just remarkable, right? And have you been to Louisville's arena? Have you been to the Young
Center? Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. The additions and the features that arenas have now, are more than just their experiences. They're not just basketball games, right? Like the Yum Center has the bourbon bars, mm-hmm. right?
You sound like you've been to them.
What's that?
You sound like you've been to the bourbon bars.
Well, you know, they had to get
excited. Just a little bit.
I had to check it out, right? I had to check it out. No, it's fascinating that actually, like, some of the arenas now with the alcohol sales, right? And I think that that's part of how some of these arenas are able to make generate some revenue too, right? Mm-hmm. Because sometimes a lot of arenas lose money.
Most of them do.
Yeah. And so I think that, you know, when you have a when some of these arenas are selling alcohol, it's, I think the Yum Arena, whatever they call it, they're one of the few arenas that actually was generating money. And I think there was some talk of them not selling alcohol at some point. And what are your thoughts on at amateur games, which I don't know if you're going to call them amateur anymore now with NIL. What are your thoughts on arenas selling alcohol during college games?
It can cause problems, but it's a part of reality of where we are, and particularly for Yum. I mean, it makes all the sense in the world for Louisville. I mean, Kentucky's the bourbon capital of the world. You just go a couple blocks down and you can go to a couple different distilleries, and, you know, Angel's Envy's right there. Those tours are great. It's part of the industry of it. University of Louisville actually has an MBA specialty in spirits. It could be anywhere, but it makes sense for them because that's part of the unique history and culture of that place. What's great about college athletics is that each school can craft their own individual brand and specialty about what they're about. The professionals try to do that, and they do it to some extent. And so you see their jerseys and stuff wandering around, whatever, but it's a college or a university has a whole community that's built around that, that is, has their own story and their own uniqueness to it. And that's, I think, what human beings, as we get more of us in a populated planet that the internet connects everything for, they're looking for that individuality of a specialness of something that they can belong to. And college athletics does that about as well as almost anything in the world.
Have there been other arenas?
That gets away from alcohol, but I think if that's, you know, some people need alcohol to enhance that experience, maybe.
sure. Have there been other architects that are designing, you know, arenas around the world that have reached out to you to talk, or do they just come and look at it and sort of take bits and pieces that they like?
Other architects are always sort of afraid the other architect might take the job away from her or something, but they generally don't. Not a great history of collaborating with each other. So I can't think of other architects that have come to talk about it other than the one conversation I did enjoy when they came down to actually selecting the architect for JPJ. One of the other people that architects that they interviewed was the one that had done Xavier. I got a chance to talk to him later about it and said, you know, I saw that and you know, I said, that was great. But, you know, I saw the opportunity of the blank wall. And he said, yeah, I missed that one. more to the point, Florida State was looking for a new arena. And so they brought me down and it's been a wonderful time down there. Leonard Hamilton's the coach and they're playing a 9 o'clock game against Duke. So they introduced me to him, but he says, game day, I got to focus on it, but I really want to talk to you. I said, okay. You know, so they play the game. It doesn't get over till about 11:15. They lose on a heartbreaker and I'm there with an assistant AD. He said, Leonard said he wants to talk to you, but all I'll do is wait. So it had to be like 1:45 finally, you know, press, the players, with tragic loss. They went home and said, Leonard still wants to talk to you. Okay. So I go into his office, 1:30, something like that. We talked for almost 3 hours. And he had been to JPJ, was impressed with it. He says, unlike anything I've ever seen. And we just had the he's And he's got this fierce scowl when he's coaching, and people might be frightened of him, but he's one of the nicest individuals I have ever spent time talking with. And we spent 3 hours literally talking about basketball and what the importance and what the facilities could do to it. So not quite another architect, but other people have called on sort of on that basis, but that one was particularly memorable.
Yeah, because I've heard others reference JPJ when they're designing their arenas. I think Oregon was one. I think
lots of people have come to look at it. Very few people have come to talk to us about it.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense.
How else has your life been impacted and your company's its value impacted by after you built JPJ?
As I said, it was a scary moment in a lot of ways. You know, we had to get bigger to do it. You know, so we fortunately are the building we're in. We rented out the rest of the building. The building was the first YMCA ever built in Charlottesville. And so the space that we didn't have was the front of it, which was the original gymnasium space of the Y. So it had a hardwood floor. We put a little basket in there, and that became the studio that we did the arena in. A couple of my partners were concerned that we were going to go belly up after this was over because we were building up all this stuff and we wouldn't possibly afford it after that. But it just put us in it, like, you know, we went up a division in sports, you know, by that. So I'm retired now, but the company's fabulously successful. We have offices in Washington, we're one of the bigger pure architecture firms around anywhere. So
great. Great to hear. Well, when I hit it big, when I hit the lottery, I'm calling on you to design my home. Hey, T-Dubs, Grant?
I was going to end it on our usual question. Your Mount Rushmore of Virginia basketball. We'll give you 5 spots.
Oh God, that's a tough question with Mark sitting here. So Ralph is easy. It depends on what the qualities of sort of Mount Rushmore are, but I'd say
whatever Ralph, you want, whatever qualities you want, best hair, best whatever you want to do.
I think Barry Parkhill, because I think he put it on the map, and he's such a great guy and embodies everything that's great about it. I probably should put Buzzy in there. He's before my time. I've met him, but I never actually got to see him play. So I'll limit it to just the ones that I've got to see play. Biased because of my year, but Wally was wonderful.
Makes sense.
And then there's 20 people for the next 2 spots. I think I would put Brian Stith in there. Not just for, so my Mount Rushmore is not just for basketball, but for the character of the individuals and what they've meant for the history of it. And then the entire starting 5 from the championship team.
That's awesome. That's a great answer. Well, since you built the stadium and the arena, we'll allow you to have 10.
Yeah, 10. Yeah, you can make room on this Mount Rushmore because you're designing.
It's only 9 then, but you know, but probably the 6th man needs to be included too. I don't remember who the exact 5 were that started the game.
That's all right. It was such a pleasure having you and awesome information. Really educational, so we really appreciate it.
Well, I enjoy what you're doing. It's interesting to I like to work in analogies, but and I'm not a big drinker, but I understand the more wine you drink, you develop a fascination for it. And I think what you're doing for Virginia sports and athletics, the more you find out behind the scenes, the even better it is. There's so many things about UVA athletics and basketball in particular that are off the charts. I wouldn't say better than anybody else, but special in the qualities of the people, the individual character qualities that all the people involved have. And I think the more people know about it, the more they can appreciate not just the wins on the court, but everything that goes into it. And it's just a much deeper appreciation of it all. And I think you're doing a great job of helping enhance that for all fans. So thank you for what you're doing.
Means a lot. Thank you very much. We appreciate that too. And for T-Dubs, Grant Kersey, once again, we are sponsored by Rhines and Rogers and Multiverse Kitchen. When you get a chance, make sure you stop by. We are out of here. Thanks so much for listening. We will see you on the next one. Take care.